You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, John.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
Excellent. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, which, by the way, John, is available both on streaming video and via audio podcast.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I agree. We agree so far. Let's see how long this lasts. Now, you may need no introduction to many people. You're an eminent journalist and, like, opiner. You've written a lot of books. The book you wrote a couple years ago was what, The Populist Revolt, Explosion? What was the final, the Populist?
The Populist Revolt? Explosion.
Explosion. Now you've written a book called The Nationalist Revival. Looks like this. Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. And we're going to talk about it. And it's about nationalism and its current manifestations and the implications of all that for the future, I guess. Now, before we start, John, I want to both credit you with something and chastise you for something, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
Thank you. We should say, actually, we've known each other for a while. So, since our days at the New Republic. So, I'm allowed to do this. Here's the chastisement. You promised us a rose garden. Okay. Do you remember the book you co-authored with Rui Teixeira?
Sure.
The Emerging Democratic Majority. Now, am I wrong in thinking that according to that book, at this very moment, we should have a Democratic president and Democratic control of, Congress?
Yeah, you're wrong.
Okay. Never mind.
Well, I mean, here was the argument was that by the end of that decade, the book came out in 2002, we would have a Democratic majority. Now, we counted on some things that would have made that majority endure that didn't come to pass. Mm-hmm. And the main thing was that we counted on the Democrats still winning about 40% nationally of the white working class. And that means majorities in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania. And that really didn't come to pass. And that began to hemorrhage really in 2010. And, you know, that's a big reason why we don't have a Democratic majority now.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of your analysis, if I recall correctly, was that, you know, the Democrats have a coalition that includes, you know, blacks, Latinos, and so on. And some of these groups seem destined to grow in size, right? Particularly Latinos. Yes. That was part of the analysis.
Yes.
And I mean, the irony, I guess, is that some people would now say that one reason the white working class deserted the Democrats more than you might have imagined was, you know, in reaction against that ethnically diverse Democratic coalition or some parts of it or what parts of it represented to them. I mean, there's on the one hand, the issue of immigration as in some ways reflected in the Latino constituency, I guess, perhaps in the eyes of some of the white working class. But more broadly, there's the whole identity politics thing, a backlash to which, according to some people, the Trump vote was energized by, and so on. So, do you buy any of that analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say what we described was a kind of is sort of the parody of it was a kind of hourglass coalition with minorities, primarily poor now rather than richer minorities at the bottom, and professionals near the top. With a bulge in the middle with the middle class and the white working class again is about 70% of those without college degrees. So it's a big group, and that bulge really disappeared. So we have more of an hourglass. And if you think about it, it's hard to, what's really happened is that the Democrats have had trouble given that coalition talking to the people in the middle.
Mm. Mm.
And to some extent, the kind of things that they sometimes say, like abolish ICE, for instance, the Immigration Service have the exactly the effect that you describe of driving away as many voters or more voters than the policies attract. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that has been the Democrats' problem. It's, you know, the code words are identity politics.
Right. Now, well, we'll get to the Trump side of identity politics momentarily, because it's not unrelated to the issue of nationalism. But the thing I want to give you credit for is you were an economic nationalist before it was cool. You were someone on the left dissenting from the neoliberal consensus ever since you were, I suppose, in the crib or something. But back when, you know, if we had followed your policies, then Trump would have, at a minimum, less he could claim he was going to do that was new, because some of what he advocated on the trade front would already be there, right?
Right.
So congratulations.
Yeah. I mean, I have a personal explanation for it, if you want to hear it.
Sure.
I mean, I'm a child of the Midwest and of Chicago, and my father manufactured dresses and my mother designed them, and they had a unionized factory in Elgin, Illinois, and they went out of business when the interstate highway started and everything began moving to the coast. And then my father was a salesman, but I'm rooted in that experience of Midwestern manufacturing. I also grew up at a time, 40s, 50s, when if you went into a store, you wanted things that were made in the USA. And it wasn't out of any patriotism. It was because they were better. They were better quality. And for people of that generation, and I'm the same generation basically as Trump, it was a real shock, the 70s and 80s, you know, when you want to buy a camera or a car or a television, there were, you know, American, if there were American brands, they were lousy.
Yeah.
So I think that experience was very important to me. And it's an experience that a lot of people didn't have. They had much different experiences. So.
Yeah, I guess I barely remember back when Made in Japan was kind of synonymous with, if not shoddy, at least cheap. It would be some cheap plastic toy.
They were knockoffs. That was when I was a kid. They were copying us.
Right. So you were there, and now we're all here. And you got this book. So you start out talking about nationalism as a thing. Now, in your acknowledgments, you say that you succeeded in mentioning Benedict Anderson only once in the course of the whole book. Benedict Anderson, famously a social scientist. I don't know, was he an historian or what? But famously used the term imagined community. He was what?
I think he was a political scientist at Cornell, but it doesn't matter.
But he will forever be known alongside the phrase imagined communities to describe what a national community is. And I guess part of the point is just that, like, it's not like a small town community where you kind of know who everybody is. It's like there's all these people you've never met, and yet you feel some kind of fraternity with them. You might go die for them in a war or something. And I mean, that's what the phrase has meant to me. Is that?
I accept that. I think that a lot of people misinterpret it to mean imaginary community, that there aren't really nations, that it's just some kind of psychological artifact. I think what he was talking about was, let's say you're paying your taxes. Your taxes are going to go for people to get unemployment compensation, welfare, what have you, that you've never seen before. That you don't know, that may be very different from you, but you do it willingly because it's part of a we. It's part of a nation, so you do it. And when that starts to break down, when people start to say, "Well, why am I supporting, you know, with my taxes, XYZ people in Orlando, Florida?" Then you have trouble. Then you start having the kind of breakdowns, which we really began to have in the 80s with Reagan, and that, you know, that they have a lot in Europe, Spain, mm-hmm. I mean, they have like, there are a lot of places where they have these kind of problems where the idea of a national community begins to break down.
Mm-hmm. And you can see why an ethnically diverse country may find that kind of cohesion a little more challenging. It isn't that like racism is inevitable or anything or hardwired or anything, but you know, famously ethnic lines are lines along which resentment can build and so on. In fact, part of Spain's issue is Catalonia, where they,
I was referring to.
Yeah. Yeah. Now before we get
here, Bob, you know, when I was in Germany in 2002, and people were giving me just a really hard time about the oncoming Iraq war and climate change, which George W. Bush was already, you know, pulling out of it. And the one thing that I really could say about America is we have all these different people and they get along. You know, you're worried about your Turks, et cetera, et cetera. Look at, I mean, again, it is the United States is an incredible achievement in that respect.
Well, has been. I mean, less now than it was when you were talking to them.
Yes, right.
I mean, I long held up the U.S. as a real success story on the ethnic diversity front. And it always annoyed me a little when, like, Norwegians or something would write books about how, you know, reprimanding us for how we were handling the race problem. Not that there's not a lot wrong, but I felt like, yes, exactly. Why don't you guys try it sometime? Diversity is not trivially easy. And now, of course, they are trying it, and they're not. Scandinavia is not handling it all that well.
Right.
But okay. One more thing about nationalism: the concept is in the acknowledgments. You say that you actually, although you did cite Benedict Anderson once, you are more aligned with the traditionalist conceptualization of nationalism than the modernist one associated with Anderson. I didn't even know there was such a distinction. So can you talk a little about what that means?
Well, the modernists are people who really think that the idea of a nation begins in 1789, or some of them think it's 1688 with the English Revolution, but it's a recent vintage. The traditionalists think it could go back to Egypt. Well, China, Japan, that you had, you know, in Hungarian history in the 16th century, people are talking about defending the nation. Now, they don't talk about it a lot, and their loyalties might be more to a feudal lord than to the nation or to a king. But at times, it pops up, and it's important. And so it has a much longer history.
This is what century in Hungary?
Oh, you know, when they were being eaten up by the Turks on the one side and the Austrians on the other. I would say it's 17th century, but don't, you know.
Well, I had thought that a lot of people would, associate nationalism, well, see the roots of it at least in the early modern era, if modern is defined broadly to be like the last five centuries or so. And a lot of people associate parts of it with the printing press. I mean, certainly printing played a role in consolidating even harmonizing language within regions where previously the dialects had been quite distinct and so on. And
all that's correct. And with the printing press, capitalism replacing feudalism, you really do start to get a much more of an idea of a nation as we know it now, and it's not something that only emerges at times of national defense when the Russians are invading Poland or something like that. Mm-hmm. Before that, it is more of a it is more something that arises at times of war.
Okay. And
you have institutions that are rooted in the nation much more than you do before. Parliaments, what have you. So yes, that's printing press, capitalism, all that stuff. So that's 17th, 18th century.
Yeah.
I think the other reason, just to continue this for a second, that I prefer the traditionalists is that you can go farther out on a limb than this than I do, but that, you know, one of the central things about groups is group solidarity. You can trace, you know, again, you can trace that back eons to kinship groups and things like that. And you can see an evolutionary pattern of the formation of the nation and of people worrying about others than themselves, of identifying with a larger group. And I think that the traditionalists make that kind of analysis easier.
They make it easier in what sense?
That you can see it, that it's not just a sudden.
Oh, sure, sure. No, I certainly agree. I mean,
oh, we have a nation and people are thinking about women themselves.
Well, as soon as you get farming, before you even have writing, you know, like whatever, 8,000 years ago or something, you get, instead of just kind of individual hunter-gatherer villages, you get collections of villages under centralized rule, chiefdoms. Right. And chiefs are certainly working to inspire a sense of common belonging.
Yes. Now, okay. So you get the idea. And, you know, and in like ancient Egypt, you get the similarities, certain similarities.
Right.
Now that's again, it's not a big deal and it might be too much off a deep end. But that's the distinction.
But certainly, in modern times, I guess, you know, you mentioned that there are national institutions in nation states like parliaments and so on. But I guess if your country is going to have those and be democratic as opposed to authoritarian, you probably need some nationalist actual sentiment, right? You need the phenomenon of nationalism in a more thoroughgoing
enduring sentiment. Yes, absolutely. And you need something like citizenship.
Yeah. Now, so one way the current moment is sometimes depicted is as ethno-nationalists, that is Trump supporters, versus cosmopolitans. And the idea, now both of those are in a sense maybe stereotypes coming from the other side, but in any event, first of all, I guess you would say that ethno-nationalism clearly is only one kind of nationalism there can be. In fact, as we were just saying, America had succeeded in being a not ethnically based nation state. And then with cosmopolitans, I guess the question on the other side is, well, if they indeed consider themselves more connected with the larger world than do, say, the Trump supporters, can they hang on to enough of their nationalism for kind of the country to work as a whole, right?
Well, let's go back to the ethno-nationalists. My view is that America was a ethno-nationalist country, Anglo-American, and that was the dominant Protestantism, the Anglo-American Protestantism, you know, going back again to 18th century, early 20th century. I was impressed by a guy, Eric Kaufman, a historian, who's written a book on it, and he describes all these, how these names, how people like, I guess Paul Revere was Rouvois. They all changed their names so they would be anglicized. Charpentier became Carpenter. So in other words, there was a kind of norm, a kind of ideal that defined the nation. And it was ethno-religious. And it keeps expanding. A lot of the turmoil from 1840s until World War II is over first, you know, the Germans and the Irish, and then the Eastern and Southern Europeans come in the 1880s and 1890s. And what does that do to this ideal? Who are we? What is an American? And we're going through the same kind of a turmoil now, where we have to decide, are these people who came to this country who speak Spanish and not English, are they really, can they be Americans? I think that we are going to make the transition, but we're in a period of turmoil similar to, let's say, the 1880s to 1920. And eventually it is going to, I mean, I like to quote the Harry Truman letter to his cousin when he goes to New York in, I think it's 1919, it's after World War I, and he comes back and he writes to her, he said, New York is 750,000 Jews, 100,000 WAPs, and a few white people. Now, the point of that is that for Truman, again, his ethno-ideal, right, white people were Anglo-American. So that had to really change. The thing that's, you know, difficult in the American experience is African-American and slavery and reconciling an ego, an ideal of the American that incorporates black people. I think that the Asians are already on the way, the Asian Americans. I think you can see that, even in this Harvard suit.
That's interesting. This may or may not be relevant, but I went to, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade in San Francisco. My junior high was majority Asian American. Mm-hmm. And this was like, 69-70. This was like the high, you know, this was like summer of love, hippiedom. And I got the impression that one thing that had changed just like that was that in this period of like radical rebellion, suddenly all the, not Caucasian students, Asian Americans, Latinos wanted to be thought of as not white fundamentally, right? And my sense was, I may have been reading my history wrong. My sense was that like even 3 years ago, it would have been different, but one feature of this like left-wing, this was San Francisco, right? I mean, and one feature of this left-wing time and place was a flipping of affiliation. Now, what you're saying is that, are you saying that, that Asian Americans are kind of, well, I guess we shouldn't generalize at all, but are you saying that there's more of a tendency to be willing to be thought of as more white than not, or what? I mean, what exactly?
Well, you know, the sociologist, now what's his name, from New York University, who's done all these studies of the census, intermarriage, for instance, among Hispanics, there's just a growing number that of the kids that think of themselves as white, and not as,
is that right?
Yes, yes.
So children from mixed marriages are identifying as white.
And the mixed marriages are increasing rapidly among both the Hispanic immigrant and the Asian immigrant population. So mm-hmm. that's going to happen, but we're still in a period where a lot of people think of America, and Mike Lynn uses the term Euro-American as the, you know, next step after that we reached after the old Anglo-American, you know, now we think of Jews and Italians and stuff. They're all part of this melting pot, but there's still a resistance. And I think that, you know, within the Trump phenomenon, there is an element of this older Euro-American ideal trying to come to terms with a new America that has these, you know, millions and millions of Hispanics and Asian Americans.
Where do you stand on this question of the extent to which Trump's support is grounded in a kind of, if not racism, then ethnically based resentment, as opposed to being based in kind of economic grievance? I mean, that's the way the thing is put, perhaps too simplistically, but, you know, it's an argument that people have been having.
Yeah, I use the notion of way of life to try to summarize this. What you have on the one hand is you have these processes of globalization and trade and what have you that have created the, you know, what the English sociologists call the left behinds, the people who were used to have middle income jobs in manufacturing, mining, what have you, who live in smaller and mid-sized towns, not necessarily rural. Rural is a wrong description. In the Midwest, in the South, in North Carolina, for instance, which turned out to be a Trump state. So that's one thing that's going on on one side. And the other process is immigration. Starts in 1965, accelerates in the 1990s. A lot of unskilled workers. In certain industries that were formerly mid-wage, unionized, meatpacking, janitorial, construction, become lower-wage, non-union, primarily immigrant, sometimes even illegal immigrant. Social costs go up in these little towns. Hazleton, you know, where the guy was running for Senate that came from, Barletta. So you have an economic grievance, but you also clearly have a certain culture shock. You know, what are these people doing with the, you know, the streets are full of Spanish language or strange Chinese characters. So, and then combine that with the threat of Islamic terror and the possibility that the people coming in are not just going to, you know, compete for jobs but blow up shopping malls. And you really have the kind of combustible situation that we've had since 2001. And, you know, the terror element is even looms much larger in Europe than it does in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
It's really a big deal, you know.
Yeah. Now, are you talking about parts of the Midwest where there actually was a substantial population of immigrants from Muslim majority nations? Or you're just saying they look at it on TV, they see it on TV, and they feel under threat, and it's even vaguely conflated with immigrants who are...
Yeah, they always say, you know, the people who are skeptical that there's anything here always say, well, you know, how many Muslims are there in this town? Or how many refugees are there in the, you know, in the state of Saxony-Anhalt in Germany? And what I quote in the book, I quote an interview with somebody from one of these East German places that voted for the Alternative for Deutschland saying, well, yeah, we don't have many, but that's exactly the point. We don't want somebody coming in and, you know, blowing up something. It's not, you know, we live in the era of the internet and television. It's not like it has to happen next door for people to be worried about it. So, yeah, that's true, but it doesn't.
So Trump gets a lot of political mileage there for the so-called Muslim ban.
I think I think if you remember in 2016, we had a whole spate of really bad terrorist attacks, didn't we? Orlando, we had San Bernardino. You know, if you think now, you say, well, nothing much is happening. But right then, during that period, there was a lot happening. And yes, I think that sort of fused with the fear of illegal immigration and all this stuff into a real issue. And that issue, from my experience, was the most important for Trump's base. I mean, when I would go to rallies and interview people, usually they'd start talking about immigration, and then it would be terror, and that would be the thing. But again, the people who made up the bulk of that base were the people from these kind of communities that had been afflicted in some respect by globalization. They weren't people who had nannies, you know, or you know, people doing their garden work who were doing it for a very low wage, and thank God they're here and stuff like that. It wasn't people from metropolitan areas.
And part of this reaction was, you think, resentment toward those kinds of people? In other words, to come back to this idea of Trumpian ethno-nationalists versus coastal elite cosmopolitans, I mean, how big a role psychologically do you see that as having played?
I think it's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you could almost go back to, I was discussing this with a friend the other day, you could go back to the 60s, and when Ronald Reagan runs for governor, he runs against he doesn't run against the free speech movement at Berkeley, he runs against the filthy speech movement. The people, the young kids who, you know, take our tax monies, go to our schools, you know, we're going to have fancy jobs and want to say, you know, dirty words out loud. In other words, they're wasting our money. That you know, again, you see that kind of culture clash, way back in the 60s, and it's continued on, and it's only grown more so in the last 10 or 15 years. It's more focused now, I think, on subjects other than religion, but it's still part of it.
Well, I think another touchstone for me is back when we were at the New Republic. I'm not sure if you were what your connection to it was then at this moment, but I had certainly met you by then, and I was there. And but the whole Murphy Brown, Dan Quayle cultural elite thing, where Dan Quayle started branding liberals as quote cultural elites. Shows like Murphy Brown, where you had a single mother. I forget what else there was about it he didn't like, but celebrating unwed motherhood or something. But that reflected an elite class that has contempt for the values of ordinary Americans. I think those last few words are probably a direct quote from several Republicans of that era. And And that was a very, I think, a pretty calculated thing.
Yes. I always thought that these people from the upper class could pull this off much better than the people who, you know, were sort of from the middle class and weren't capable of the kind of cynicism that, let's say, George H.W. Bush was during the 1980s.
Yeah. And Dan Quayle himself wasn't born in a ghetto, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, no. Arizona Republic. I mean, you know, the big newspaper chain. Absolutely. Oh, that's what I'm saying. Yes, absolutely. They understood that was an issue, the culture clash going back to that.
So one question is, like, how fundamental is this? I mean, to some extent, it seems like a product of pretty fundamental forces. I mean, globalization has drawn affluent people in many countries in closer connection with one another, the business class, and at the same time, in affluent countries like the U.S., it has, while on the one hand, you know, lifting people out of poverty in Asia, it has increased the economic competition that working class Americans face and therefore held their wages down and so on. So, I mean, the forces in many ways seem pretty fundamental.
Yeah. I mean, let me just talk about the cosmopolitans for a second, because that's an interesting other side to it. The I cite this book by David Goodhart, The Road to Somewhere, that I really like. It's an analysis of the Brexit vote more than anything else. And he distinguishes between the somewheres, which are the people whose lives are still rooted in town, church, community, and the anywheres, people who basically think they can live in Paris, London, Barcelona, well, what have you. But now, if you look at both those groups, if you divide them into nationalists and cosmopolitans, the cosmopolitans, the people who, let's say, live in the Bay Area, in my Washington, Maryland, where I live, and they're not against nationalism. They're not against America. I mean, there's always people at the fringes. There's the alt-right, and I guess there's an alt-left. I mean, their heartstrings pulled when 9/11 happened. They were, you know, they would have gone to fight in Afghanistan at that point. But it's one identity among a lot of different ones. Professor, he's, you know, worries about his books. He's a member of the university. A guy who works for a big firm. He has his company. He has a lot of different identities. What's really happened, and this is again where the left behinds with the economics and the culture combined, is that a lot of the identities get stripped away. The local pub, the factory, you know, lifetime employment, so that the nation and the flag become so much more important than they might otherwise have been. You know, he's a flag on the porch, not pretty much in the area that I live in. It's very rare. But it's not that the people aren't patriots, but it's just not that important. There are issues, obviously, and, you know, you saw that with Obama, where you can go past this culture clash, and many of them are economic, are taking, you know, some recognition of what the economic problems are. But it's a real problem between, you know, let's say Akron or Youngstown on the one hand and San Francisco and Boston on the other, how to get those in the same nation.
Yeah. Did you know that 3 of my 4 siblings voted for Trump?
No. Well, you come from Texas, right?
Well, my parents were both.
You're an Army brat.
I'm an Army brat. My parents were both from Texas, West Texas, and I grew up in several. I lived in several different towns in Texas, were among the places I grew up. But I don't think it's so much about that. I have trouble believing that both of my parents would have voted for Trump. But anyway, this is just something I mention about every 5th podcast, so I thought I'd mention it.
That's good.
It's a little surprising to me, but one thing it does reveal is the diversity of motivations for voting. There's diversity within these 3 people.
Right. Like, you've got your
evangelical, for whom it's all about abortion and who's on the Supreme Court. Then you've got your not just Hillary hater, but Clinton hater, Bill and Hillary hater. who, as it was put to me the night before the election, just wants to, quote, throw a wrench into the works.
Right.
Which, and hey, mission accomplished. You know, not in that case, at least, no great ill will toward Obama or anything. It's a complicated thing.
We have friends that voted for Trump, but they were Republicans and they hated Hillary. So yes, there was a diversity of ways in which people, but there's a kind of core phenomenon that goes from the United States to Europe.
Right.
That I'm trying to look at.
And so, have we covered the things already? Have we discussed the things that America has in common with those European countries that explains this?
Well, I wanted to say before we left America, I wanted to say one other thing that I discovered when I spent a day in a suburb of an Ohio town doing interviews with Trump voters. And we sat in a motel and talked for the afternoon. And guns kept coming up a lot. And I think, again, you find that, you know, with mm-hmm. Republican voters for the last 30 or 40 years.
Sure.
But it made me think about it a little. It wasn't really, it's not really so much about hunting. Well, that's part of it. It's, again, for people who don't live in a big city, that makes more sense. It's defending the home.
Uh-huh.
Again, it's part of a very basic identity and way of life. So again, hug, home, church, guns, all these things are a way of life that seem to be under attack. And that's part of what Trump is appealing to.
Yeah, but when you think about the communications gap here, it just kind of makes you despair, because it's not like there's any serious initiative on the left that I'm aware of to actually take guns away from people like that.
Yes, right. there is a communication, but I think again, what they feel is a contempt on the part of other people for the way they live and for the fact that they want to have guns in their house.
Yeah,
I think and it gets translated into fear of kind of crazy legislative things. People will make the guns completely illegal. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. So if we do move to Europe and do a compare and contrast, I guess we've already touched on some things. You've mentioned that in Europe, too, immigration is a big issue, although higher, if you compare the fear of terrorism to the fear of competition for jobs, you know, associated with immigration, higher ratio of terrorism to jobs, right, in Europe.
Absolutely, and crime and things like that. Mm-hmm. Take Sweden, where they just had an election, and the Sweden Democrats, which is a right-wing nationalist party, I don't know, I think they got 17%, and they're now like the German alternative for Deutschland. They really have they prevent any of the other parties from actually getting a majority. So they're a big swing vote in those countries. I saw a comparison of this. If you compare the number of refugees that Sweden took from 2014 to 2017, the proportion to what it would mean for the United States to have taken that proportion given its population, America would have taken in 9 million refugees during that period, most of whom would come from the Middle East, Africa, places like that. And you can imagine the kind of explosion that would happen in this country. And in Sweden, a lot of the problem isn't so much that they're taking jobs, but that they can't get jobs because it's a very high-tech, highly educated labor force. So they really have people who are just, hanging around and rising crime and things like that. I mean, the other thing that's similar to the United States, again, is that let's say in Hungary, Orban's vote is not in Budapest. It's in the small towns outside of there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the whole country were Budapest, he would not be in power.
Well, same here with Trump.
I mean, you asked me, similarity.
Yeah.
In law and justice in Poland, same thing. If Warsaw, you know, they're not a majority. By any means. In Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, older East Germany, And again, people say, well, they're doing fine. You know, I mean, they're getting some money. They're doing better than people in, you know, in Spain, but comparatively they're not. They're now, they have like half the standard of living of somebody who lives in, let's say Munich or Frankfurt or something like that. So again, there's a, there is a kind of economic resentment, but that only locates who the people are, and then you put that together with the fear of terror and immigrants and what are all these refugees coming in and destroying our society, and you get a base for the kind of right-wing nationalism and populism that we're seeing in Europe.
Now, is trade a big issue in Europe the way it is in America?
Not as much.
Yeah.
No.
Now, in, you know, Ian...
In France, there's a runaway shop issue in France.
But meaning?
Companies leaving for overseas or somewhere else, or, you know, things like that.
So a little of that.
Not as much, and in Britain too, but not as much, no, certainly not in Germany and not in Austria. Mm-hmm. What you said, the disproportionately, if you put the balance, the crime, terror, refugee immigration thing is much more important.
Yeah. Ian Bremmer, in his book, Us Versus Them, puts a lot of emphasis on automation. I mean, maybe it's more in his assessment of the future of kind of Trumpism, but, also, of course, a lot of economists will say in our popular discourse, trade is overemphasized relative to automation, and technological change generally, as a source of, you know, disruption of the job landscape. But do you have a view on that?
Well, we've lost some jobs because of automation, but I imagine too we've gained them too. I'm a skeptic when it comes to the idea that we're going to suddenly become jobless. I mean, a lot of the manufacturing jobs go into services. I once counted the number of yoga instructors there are in the United States. It's like 300,000 or something. I mean, we develop all these new activities. My concern about things like manufacturing, and again, I'm not speaking as a Trump supporter or explaining them, is not the, is not that we should be making t-shirts, but again, advanced manufacturing. 3D printing, things like that, the computers. That's a field that we really have to do. And the result of that is not necessarily going to be millions and millions of jobs, but it'll be an economic surplus over which we can finance a welfare state, for instance. I mean, that's more my concern than the sheer number of jobs lost in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. So I have not yet asked you to actually state the thesis of your book. I think we may have covered some of it almost without trying. But what do you say when people say, what's your argument?
You're the first person to even ask me that.
Well, that's what I'm for.
my argument is that there's like 400 arguments in the damn thing. But I suppose the key contention is that after World War II, we got this idea of nationalism as something that was identifiable with Hitler and Mussolini and should be avoided at all costs. In Europe, you could not use the word nationalist until very recently. It was just forbidden because it was so much associated with Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has in a way misled us into not understanding the importance of national identity. And particularly in terms of understanding, of creating a politics that appeals to more people than just the global elites. Because you really democracy only works in relatively small spaces. It can work in nations. It can't work in, that's the problem the Europeans are having with the EU. So, The book is really an argument for understanding why this revival of nationalism has a certain justifiable core to it, even if its expression is often bigoted, authoritarian, something we should avoid at all costs.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, there's been a kind of distinction between nationalism, which had negative vibes, and patriotism, which had positive vibes. I've always been a little unclear on where exactly the dividing line is. Yeah. It seems like a pretty fine line.
Yeah, we're not talking science. These are not, I always say that to people when I was doing populism, these are not the scientific terms like force and mass that you can create formulas about. And political scientists who do that often produce papers that are nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's one, you know, famous political scientist who wrote a book about nationalism where he defined it in such a way that the United States and India were not nations. Now, you know, that's fine. You can do that, but I try in my own work to rely to some extent on ordinary usage and to build from that.
Okay. Now I'm going to give you some guidance here that will not be interest to our audio listeners. Our viewers are going to love it. If you could move the webcam a little toward your right, so, cause you're leaning that way anyway. And also, might take some of that backlight out and we'd see more of your charming face. So what is the prognosis in terms of, you know, you can imagine a number of paths. You can imagine us veering toward exactly the kind of nationalism that gave nationalism a bad name. And some people would say we've already veered that way quite appreciably in the last few years. And then you can imagine some kind of sunny scenario that involves national healing of a kind that I'm having growing trouble imagining. What's your take?
Well, I'm hoping that we develop some kind of liberal or left-wing version of nationalism. I think a prerequisite of that would be to take the fears that people have about immigration and in Europe about refugees much more seriously than social democrats or Christian democrats have. I mean, the alternative for Deutschland would not exist if Merkel had not been so blithe about the admission of refugees. Again, I figured out what their numbers, and in a year they admitted the equivalent in the United States of somewhere between 5 and 6 million refugees. I think it was 1.2, and you can add that. So again, you can get an idea of the kind of explosion that created. And she was doing fine, you know, until there were those riots in Cologne on New Year's Eve, and then it completely changed. But it's not like those came from nowhere, like nobody could anticipate that anything like
that. Was that the one where the guys were groping the women?
Yes, and then there were terrorist attacks in Berlin.
I mean, nothing works quite like they're coming after our women, as yeah. Trump himself kind of picked up on by suggesting that, you know, immigrants were rapists during the campaign.
Yes, exactly. So I think I think take that more seriously. Do we need as many unskilled immigrants coming into the country? Should we make more priority about skilled immigration? Is illegal immigration or unauthorized or whatever you want to call it something that we should be concerned with at all, or should we just have open borders? I think there's been not enough attention to that on the part of the liberals and the left. You know, I guess the other thing I see sometimes is a kind of, if Trump says that it can't be so. You know, if he says that China's cheating us on trade stuff and stealing our secrets, I mean, you know, then it can't be. These people not be doing that. And that's something I worry about. I worry that the next, even if you look at the 2018 election, I worry that it's going to be fought entirely over his egregiousness. And believe me, there's plenty of egregiousness, but that it'll be a kind of repeat of 2016, where Hillary ran primarily against what an awful guy he was. And it just reinforced these kind of this cultural clash that we've been discussing.
Well, it keeps you from addressing issues that might win you some Trump voters, and it reinforces his narrative that we hate him and all who like him, you know.
Yes, exactly.
That's yeah, so you mentioned trade there. What do you think of his, and you mentioned things you're not supposed, you know, the prohibition on commending him for anything. What do you think of the version of NAFTA 2.0, whatever it is he's calling it, that his administration negotiated?
You know, I'm not a trade expert. I've written about it a lot over the years, but it's really into fine details. I would say marginally it's better than what we had, and that one of the things he did was increase the rules of origin. So more things, more parts will be manufactured in the United States and Mexico. What it'll actually do probably is it will encourage foreign companies to manufacture more stuff here. I don't know what it'll do as far as Ford and GM go, because that's the greatest, that they're not making cars anymore. They're making trucks. So, I think with Canada, you know, milk, okay, good. So, you know, with dairy farmers, I don't think there were major concessions.
Yeah, that's been overstated, I think, the extent to which Canada opened up its dairy market.
Yes. So, marginally good. China, you know, I cannot tell what their negotiating strategy is. If it's just to change the trade deficit, the numbers, I don't think that that's sufficient. I think, you know, you can argue that we have to some degree have a trade deficit because there has to be all these dollars in circulation for the dollar to be a universal currency, and we benefit from that. So, you know, by itself, I don't think reducing the trade deficit is a big deal. The cyber theft, the technology transfer, the hidden subsidies, you know, those things happen. But again, I don't know how you do that in negotiations. Do they promise not to do any cyber theft? I mean, what's the, I don't know what his negotiating strategy is. And I fear it's just going to end up with soybeans. You know, we'll buy more soybeans. And that's not enough. That's not what we need.
I mean, the more mainstream, the closer to mainstream critique of our relationship with China has had to do, as you say, with things like technology transfer. And I think there are people who say, yeah, we should make it so that they do less in the way of taking our technology and leaving it at that and so on. But Trump's strategy does not seem really directed towards specific objectives like that. It's just like, here's some tariffs, screw you. Do something or other.
You're tying up your hands. I don't know either. I don't know what the strategy is, because I don't see what the demands are yet. I don't see what what he really wants. The only thing that's sometimes hinted is this things about intellectual property.
Right.
But that's
no more knockoffs of movies and songs and I guess patents as well. I don't know.
Yes.
I actually think one thing they're doing now is the midterms approach is like, it's starting to look like there's going to be no resolution with China as there was with Canada and Mexico. And they seem to be going out of their way more and more to depict China as the enemy. And I'm wondering if they think that'll take the heat off of them for the trade issue. It's like, well, if China's our enemy, of course you know, you want a trade war. They're bad, right? I don't know. But there's been a lot of heated rhetoric about China on a number of fronts from like Pence lately.
China's a big issue with the Trump voters, period.
The voters or the elites? I mean, I know the Republican foreign policy establishment is hawkish on China, but you think the voters are because they perceive economic competition with China as a big threat?
Yes. It's a big deal in the Midwest.
Okay.
North Carolina, all the furniture people went to Mexico. They didn't go to China. But in the Midwest, there is still a tremendous amount of resentment that the U.S. government allowed China to undercut all their factories.
Okay.
So Trump is speaking to that. I think that's... So I think it's probably in his benefit that there's no resolution now of that. NAFTA's different. I mean, I think, you know.
Although the farmers who are hurting from the soybean tariffs would like to signs of reconciliation on the trade front, I think, with China.
Yes, that's true. They would.
The So did you get around to telling me whether I should be depressed or upbeat about the future?
No, you know, I've always been somebody known for my pessimism, but I don't know. You know, the climate stuff bothers me a little, even though I try to stay out of those kind of issues. I mean, Trump is really letting seems to me to be letting the environment go to hell.
Well, what worries me is, that does worry me, but also just all the issues we're not addressing that require international, you know, addressing at the international level. You know, biotechnology is going to permit these like very spooky bioweapons. Nobody's doing anything about it. And you know, tensions continue to persist of the kind that could lead to a group that wanted to use bioweapons and so on. I mean, you know, or the outer, it's like, we're going to have a space force, you know, with no thought to the idea that maybe, working with other countries to keep space from becoming a battleground would maybe be the best thing for all concerned. There's just none of that stuff is on the table. Right?
Well, that is really the darkest side of Trump's nationalism, is that it's not compatible with any kind of internationalism. And he really does seem to disdain international organizations.
Yep, quite so.
The only alliances that he really seems to make are in the Mideast with that character from Saudi Arabia, Netanyahu.
And the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
you mentioned him.
Yes.
Yeah. Who apparently recently, had a journalist, by some accounts, not just killed, but chopped up into pieces and snuck out of an embassy. We'll see what the deal is with that. But, that guy has charmed the whole American elite. There's pictures of that guy with like, Jeff Bezos, I think Bezos, certainly Bill Gates, Tom Friedman wrote a gushing piece about him.
He let women drive. You know, he's going to let women drive, and he's going to.
Yeah, the ones he doesn't arrest for advocating it, he lets drive.
Exactly.
I mean, don't get me into our Middle East policy. Do me a favor, John. Don't get me talking about our foreign policy generally, or specifically Middle East policy. But on this internationalism front, you distinguish in the book between globalism and internationalism, right? Yeah. Is that your distinction, or should I have already known that?
No, that's a very tricky distinction that I hit upon, you know, just as I was rewriting the book.
So what is the distinction?
Well, I guess it's globalization as the subordination of nations to the market, to the international market. A CEO saying, I don't really have an American company. I have a global company. Internationalism is the need for nations to band together to try to address certain problems like the ones you're talking about, nuclear proliferation, bioterrorism, diseases, climate change, things like that. And so, and also we need some kind of an international economic organization to address when we have these kind of crises with financial contagion that spreading from one place to another. So I am for internationalism, but it has to be a combination of that and nationalism.
Well, and I mean, it does seem to me there are more leftish forms of internationalism or global governance, you might say, and less left-wing. And one thing I like about the NAFTA is, I mean, this may actually have no actual impact, but a couple of the features are Mexico agreeing to permit unionization, I gather, and this thing where a certain number of auto parts and cars that are going to trade freely within the zone, certain percentage have to be made by workers making at least $16 an hour or something. Now that may have no impact, but things that would tend to put a floor under wages in low wage countries and in that way raise production costs there and ease the competition with affluent countries. I'm in favor of, and environmental accords can also, environmental dimensions of these trade agreements can have the same impact of raising production costs in the low wage countries. And I mean, there's no point in doing that so much that there's no trade, or even that the trade doesn't grow. But I think if you had more of these kind of leftish features of international trade agreements, including in principle in the WTO, could happen in theory. I think you'd have had less support for Trump to begin with if that had been a really systematic effort all the way. So there is that.
We argued that a long time ago. It was an argument with NAFTA too.
Yeah. No, I've been arguing it for a while, and you were
all nominal. I mean, it was all stuff that nothing ever happened.
Yeah, NAFTA had nominal features like that, but they were pretty nominal.
Yes.
And thrown in at the last minute to appease unions, I think.
The thing that people say about the $16 an hour is that, and even the parts agreements, is that the penalty for not doing that stuff and shipping stuff into the United States is 2.5%, which is not, you know, which is something that a lot of companies can swallow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think the precedent is as important as anything else. The idea of a specific wage.
Yes. Let's agree on that. And even if it has a very marginal effect, it's good. Even if it's, you know.
Yeah. And I gather the incoming left-wing government in Mexico actually likes these features.
Yes.
Which is good. Let's see what else. So I'm not any more encouraged after talking to you, but what else? Is there anything else in the book? But that's not your job, John. You're not my therapist. I don't want you to feel guilty about your failing to cheer me up. Okay.
Okay.
But is there anything else in the book you want to talk about?
Not that I can think of right now.
We've pretty much covered the waterfront.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's nice, you know, it's cool because it's, what is this, 45,000 words or something?
Yes. Both books were about that, yes.
Very, you know, brisk little read. Now, this is one of these Columbia Global Reports. This is a line of books being put out by Nick Lemon, formerly dean of the Columbia Journalism School. A few of them have come out. Tim Wu, coiner of the term net neutrality, has got one coming out on antitrust and the need to break up some companies. In fact, I'm going to be talking to him about that in a couple of weeks. But they're a good feature of the literary landscape, I think.
I'll tell them.
Yeah. Do they pay you real money?
Yes. And it's like a fancy magazine article because they pay my expenses to do the article.
Really? Now, that doesn't happen in the world of books.
I know. And that's what's really wonderful. So I spent, you know, a month. More than a month, 6 weeks in Europe for both books. So it's a.
Oh, I may want to get on this gravy train.
Yeah.
I've been thinking we need to know more about Hawaii. You know?
Yes.
50th state, 49th state, whatever the hell. See, I don't even know. That's what I mean. We need to know more about Hawaii.
And my wife is headed toward Hawaii. That's right.
Yeah. Well, I may beat her there. Okay, well, thank you. And then once we get off camera, you're going to tell me exactly how much they paid for you. Paid you for this, exactly what you mean by real money. You probably don't want to say that on camera, right?
Yes, I don't think that would be right. So we'll talk about it.
It's your last chance. I'm about to turn the camera off. You sure?
Turn the camera.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, John. The book is The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. Where else can people find you? You're not that active on Twitter, are you? Are you active at all?
I have an account. I try not to write on it because I'm worried I'll say things that'll get me in trouble.
This has been known to happen.
Exactly.
Yep. You could have been the next Elon Musk if you had made that mistake. Okay. Thanks a lot, John.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits of Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.